In ancient days, when to travel too far meant a nasty fall from the edge of a flat and finite earth, and when everyone was convinced that life in the unknown lands was, at best, barbaric, the mapmakers could hardly be blamed for making their familiar marginal note.
Here be dragons.
Today, of course, though our maps may not be geophysically perfect, they serve our needs pretty well. And there's no such place as an unknown land anymore. Yet in a sense, the dragons are still with us. Not in our land, naturally. But somewhere, vaguely, over there.
United Nations Radio presents Down with Dragons. A program about international understanding, and in particular, a 10-year UNESCO project designed to foster mutual appreciation of the cultures of East and West.
An apartment block in a big city. A hot night after a hot day at the end of a hot week. In one apartment, much gaiety. In another, much and mounting irritation as two tired people toss and turn.
Are you asleep?
What do you think?
Oh, I wish it would cool off.
And I wish them apes across the courtyard would shut up. That's it. That does it.
In two strides is at the open window.
Hey, you!
Yeah? What do you want?
Are you going to shut that thing off? Or do I have to come over there in person and smash it with my own two hands? Huh?
Them animals. And nothing but animals.
Which just goes to show, close togetherness is no guarantee of good relations. Now, widen the view somewhat. Remember when radio was still a novelty? We watched it grow and we said...
Marvellous thing, you know. Nation speaking to nation just like that should do wonders for peace.
But now we know it ain't necessarily so. True, nations do speak to nations 24 hours a day. At this very moment, we are moving slowly across the shortwave bands. But what are they saying? And how much do their audiences care, anyway? Telecommunications and jet planes have indeed made this a very small planet. The platitudes on their point swarm round us like locusts. But it's no guarantee of good relations either. So, what's the trouble? Let's look back. In the 16th century, an Italian missionary, Matteo Ricci, followed the footsteps of Marco Polo and ended up having tea with the Emperor of China in the imperial capital, Peking. As a conversation piece, he produced from his satchel a brand new map of the world.
As you can see, sir, it is the very latest map. It shows the newly discovered continent of America.
Most interesting.
In here, right in the center, is the city of Rome.
Show me, please. Where is Peking? I do not see it.
Here, sir, over on the right-hand edge of the map.
Your map is wrong. Rome is not the center. I rule the Middle Kingdom. And in the middle of the Middle Kingdom is Peking. And in the middle of Peking is the Temple of Heaven. And the Temple of Heaven is the exact center of the whole world.
Oh, no, sir, I assure you. Everyone agrees that Rome
Please,
is...
Please, you may go now.
Onward to the 18th century, and another meeting between East and West. In 1793, a British envoy returned to the court of King George III after a visit to the Emperor Qianlong.
May it please your Majesty, a missive from the Emperor.
Read it, please.
You, O King, impelled by your humble desire to partake of the benefits of our civilization, have dispatched a mission respectfully bearing your memorial.
Don't think I care for his attitude very much. Go on.
I have perused your memorial. The earnest terms in which it is couched reveal a respectful humility on your part, which is highly praiseworthy.
Egad!
If I have commanded that the tribute offerings sent by you, O King, are to be accepted, this was solely in consideration for the spirit which prompted you to dispatch them from afar. Our dynasty's majestic virtue has penetrated into every country under heaven, and kings of all nations have offered their costly tribute by land and sea. As your ambassador can see for himself, we possess all things. I set no value on objects strange or ingenious, and have no use for your country's manufactures.
Enough! We will not listen to such insolence.
Is this, perhaps, the trouble? We don't want to be dogmatic about it, but maybe it is, or at least an important element in it. Egocentricity at the individual level and ethnocentricity at the national. These are qualities, of course, which are not confined to emperors, monarchs, or missionaries, or any particular people. Nor are they exclusively characteristic of the past. We dredge the past for our two examples because, to quote contemporary parallels, might be a little invidious. And anyway, as the past is part of the present, we can't escape it if we want to see the relations between nations today in their true perspective. So let's take another and more serious look at history.
Madam President and friends, I wonder if this loudspeaker carries my voice to the farthest end of this vast audience. Will some of those who are far away will raise their hands if they listen to what I'm saying? Do you listen? All right.
This is the voice of a great man, slender of build, grey hair so thin it was little more than a fuzz on his dark-skinned head, a stubbly moustache, steel-rimmed glasses over eyes that could express everything but contempt and hate.
I was wondering what I was to speak to you. I wanted to collect my thoughts. I tried to scribble a few words. You will be sorry to hear from me that that piece of paper is not by my side. But that is nothing.
This is the voice of Mahatma Gandhi. The recording was made in March 1947, when India's passage to independence was all but formally complete. The vast audience he spoke to had assembled in Delhi from many parts of Asia. The essence of what he said to them is in this one paragraph near the end of his speech.
If you want to give a message again to the West, it must be a message of love. It must be a message of truth. There must be a conquest. Please, please, please. That will interfere with my speech, and that will interfere with your understanding also. I want to capture your hearts and don't want to receive your claps. Let your hearts clap in unison with what I'm saying, and I think I shall have finished my work.
A message again to the West. In the perspective of history, the key word there is again, a repetition. And the original? In a Buddhist temple, the drum call to prayer. and the chant of priests.
The one who is clean, who is without vices, who finds out the truth by himself, I take this one as my refuge. The good teaching of the one who has found out the truth by himself, I take this teaching as my refuge. The good disciples of the one who has found out truth by himself, I take these disciples as my refuge.
From the East, the spiritual heritage of almost all mankind. The messages of love and truth by the Buddha, Confucius, Jesus, Krishna, Lao Tse, Mahavira, Mahomet, Moses, Zarathustra. Messages variously given, variously interpreted, variously enshrined. Yet however the formal arrangements of stone and glass and tile and gold may differ from the Shwe Dagon and the Angkor Wat to Al-Masjid Al-Haram and Al-Azhar to Salisbury and St. Peter's, the essential sense of unity, the ultimate aspiration of all, remains. This Eastern heritage, now the heritage of all, cannot be denied. But in the perspective of history and within the context of East-West understanding today, it has, perhaps because of the universal tendency to oversimplify difficult relationships, contributed to some rather misleading ideas. The obvious one, of course, is the not uncommon Western view that the East is peopled entirely by nail-bedded mystics, and therefore incomprehensible and unchangeable.
The end of the fight is a tombstone white, with the name of the late deceased, and the epitaph drear, "A fool lies here who tried to hustle the East."
A little couplet by the poet Kipling, written no doubt with all the conviction typical of the 19th century in the West. But let it be admitted, conversely, that there's a not uncommon Eastern view that the West is entirely empirical in its outlook, and therefore probably unprincipled and incurably addicted to material comfort. Now, the only trouble about these ideas and distinctions is that if they mean anything at all, they've only arisen in fairly recent times, in, say, the last 300 or 400 years. They ignore the East's early and quite unmystical achievements in science, architecture, engineering, mathematics, and medicine. They ignore, too, the fact that, far from it being impossible for the twain to meet, East and West have been in touch with each other culturally and commercially on a more or less continuous basis for thousands of years. Marco Polo was only one of the many Western businessmen who went east on trade missions to buy silks and spices and jewels and perfumes. True, in the early stages, the West didn't have much to offer in return, except in the cultural field. Greek or Buddhist art is a conspicuous example. Many of the first representations of the Buddha in stone are unmistakably Greek in character. The distinctively Oriental sculptures were evolved later. So when and how did the distinctions recognized by our immediate forefathers so firmly begin to take shape? We've already noted the probable contribution of the spiritual tradition. There were other and possibly more direct influences as well. On the banks of the Rhine in the 1450s, Johann Gutenberg rediscovered the Eastern art of printing. The green light for the onrush of adventure and achievement called the Renaissance. At the end of the century, Columbus, searching for a quick route to Cathay, found the American continent. Vasco da Gama, rounding the Cape of Good Hope, bypassed the Middle East as a trade route to India. The age of discovery was underway, and the rush for riches, spurred on by the bitter rivalry between the Dutch, English, French, Portuguese, and Spanish East India companies.
You will see that Holland has an entire monopoly of trade with the East Indies. No other nation will be permitted any share whatever.
The instructions from the Dutch company's board of control to its first governor general, Pieter Boot, in 1608. Similarly, in London, with the English Company's instructions to its first governor, Sir Thomas Smythe, in 1600.
By royal charter, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth has conferred upon us the sole right of trading with the East Indies. Unauthorized interlopers are liable to forfeiture of ships and cargo.
Nobody really expected peaceful cooperation, and there wasn't any. Except during one solemnly comic hour in 1619, London and Amsterdam concluded what they called a treaty of defence to prevent disputes between the two companies. Its terms were transmitted to the respective fleets in Far Eastern waters, and a stately and courteous little ceremony was staged.
Dress out all flags! Man the yards!
The two fleets passed in review, each in line ahead. The order was for cheers and a salute of cannon.
Ship's company will give three cheers!
Shiver me timbers. Treachery.
The story goes that it took just an hour to organize this goodwill gesture. But before the cannon smoke of the salute had cleared away, the game was on again. The violent scramble was resumed for forts, factories, and fat profits, which everyone in the business, by the way, certainly earned. When the Dutch company, for example, was at its height in the mid-17th century, the Board of Control in Amsterdam would get facts like these in its annual report.
Gentlemen, the company now commands 150 trading ships, 40 warships, and 10,000 soldiers. Thanks to their vigilance, the insolent sallies of the French and the English have been countered, and I am happy to declare, for this year, a dividend of 40%.
The tide, which for centuries had flowed gently but continuously from east to west, was turning turbulently in the opposite direction. The companies, with arms and quite astonishing independence, carried on until even the home governments eventually decided that things had gone far enough. The trading posts and the spheres of private interest became the formal colonies of the 19th century. And east-west relations in all these years? Any mutual understanding, as people in touch with people?
My dearest mother.
One can imagine it. A promising young executive, writing home from a distant post.
You ask about the natives. I fear, mother dear, there is little I can tell you. We have, you see, been very busy. Yet I'll hazard this opinion. You would find their mode of dress, when it is not plainly immodest, inelegant. Their food we do not eat, but I am told it is curious in the extreme, with dire effects upon the cultivated taste and digestion. Perhaps, my dear mother, you will speak for me to father, and urge that the time has come for my promotion, and return to the head office at home. Of course, you know this is something...
Young Daniel in a den of dragons. His was a widespread attitude throughout the pre-colonial and colonial ages. The natives were exasperatingly different. The merchants, missionaries, soldiers, and civil servants who were obliged to meet them were busy men, impatient to buy, to sell, to contract, and to convert. But to understand, that takes patience, and only a few dedicated professional Orientalists had enough of it. So the dragons thrived, and as the growth of steam-powered industry gave added strength to the colonial powers, and as the colonial people seemed to slip further and further behind the march of progress, they appeared, in many eyes, as odder and odder and odder creatures. Until... Until our own times, until now, the present...
Our memories may be a millstone round our necks. It's good now and then to deposit them in the cloakroom of modern times and let them stay there.
These are 20th century words, written only a few months ago by a Lebanese statesman, the permanent delegate of his country to UNESCO, Charles Amoun. Continue the quote.
People must forget that they once occupied a country and had to govern it by main force, that they exploited it economically, humiliated it by all sorts of legal or devious discriminatory practices, disparaged its culture and language, and cast scorn on its institutions and faith. With this over and done with, the only possible reconquest is a cultural one.
Words directed to the West, and words, too, for the East.
We are asking the Occident to forget, but we shall ask the Orient to remember. We shall ask it to remember all the benefits conferred by hygiene, science, and education, the roads, ports, and hospitals that have been built, and the modern techniques which have been thrown open to it, and on which its salvation depends.
Forty or 50 years ago, it would have been well nigh impossible, intellectually, for anyone in the East or the West to think in such terms, to make such suggestions. When our century was young, the geopolitical and economic relations in a Western-dominated world didn't encourage flexible attitudes or minds responsive to change. But now our century is middle-aged. We've cracked the old foundations with two world wars and an assortment of smaller ones. We've taken the elemental, invisible source of all power and fashioned from it the ultimate dragon, the only dragon we now need to fear. What was is no longer. What may be can already be glimpsed in the new political, economic, and cultural contours of our time. The exultant cry of millions throughout Asia and Africa, greeting freedom as a reality or a prospect. The clamorous din of industry in lands awakened from the rural sleep of centuries, the tractor replacing the ox, the steelworks beside the mud brick cottage.
Cuba? Yes. Czechoslovakia? Yes. Denmark? Yes, Dominican Republic.
The nations assembled within the terms of a charter which reaffirms the equal rights of men and women of nations large and small.
Depending on temperament and background, reactions to this evolution may vary.
This is a quotation, in translation from the Swedish, from a speech which Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations, gave not long ago to the Academic Association of the University of Lund.
One may reach back for the imagined calm of the closed world. One may find one's spiritual home in the very disintegration of the European world of the fading 19th century. Or one may reach ahead towards the glimpse of a new synthesis, inspired by the dream of a new culture, in which there is achieved, on a level encompassing the whole world, what once seemed to have become a regional reality in Europe.
Now, anyone taking the pulse beats or watching the temperature chart of international relations today may well conclude that a new synthesis is a pretty remote possibility, that the dream is pretty forlorn. But is it? The whole concept of the United Nations is based on a philosophy of solidarity. If there's no solidarity, it's not the fault of the concept or the philosophy. And anyway, the present process of evolution has carried us a long way beyond the basic idea. In the economic and political spheres, the institutions and the machinery exist to promote genuine understanding through continuous and close contact. And in the cultural sphere? It has been said that the days of cultural tribalism are over, that we no longer have cultural enclosures, each neatly separated. Yet between this, for instance... And this. Between these two, there is a difference that can't be measured simply in miles. To an unresponsive Western ear, the tonalities of Eastern music may well sound like the voice of a dragon, not to mention the possible effects of Wagnerian thunder on Eastern ears. And further, if you don't restrict yourself to music, painting, poetry, drama, all the incidental expressions of a culture, but define it in these terms.
Culture means the total accumulation of material objects, ideas, symbols, beliefs, sentiments, values, and social forms which are passed on from one generation to another in any given society.
If you take that as a reasonable basis, the differences between East and West can loom very large, but not so large that they're insurmountable.
3 years ago, the General Conference of UNESCO, meeting in New Delhi, unanimously launched a major project to extend over 10 years. Its objective, to promote the mutual appreciation of Eastern and Western cultural values. The key word, perhaps, is appreciation, which, joined to values as expressions of the human spirit and man's more or less conscious ideals, can help to create a worldwide sense of moral solidarity and a recognition of cultural interdependence, as clear as the recognition we already have of economic interdependence. In ways too numerous to mention here, organizations in almost every one of UNESCO's member states are actively translating the ideas behind the project into positive programs in schools, universities, adult education groups, through the media of information. If, after 10 years, the movement has gained enough momentum to continue by itself, if East and West have become both more keenly aware of the links which bind them, if they see proof every day of mutual respect, then the Delhi decision of 1956 will not have been made in vain.
Earlier in this program, we heard the voice of Mahatma Gandhi. We hear him again now, not in his own voice, but through some words he once wrote but never recorded on tape or disc. He said,
"I do not want my house to be walled in on all sides and my windows to be stuffed. I want the culture of all lands to be blown about my house as freely as possible. But I refuse to be blown off my feet by any."
This, in the middle age of our century, would seem to be as solid a foundation stone as any upon which to build a new world edifice, a new understanding, a new synthesis, devoid of all dragons.
Down with Dragons was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio. Detailed information about the major project on the mutual appreciation of Eastern and Western cultural values can be obtained from the headquarters of UNESCO, Place de Fontenoy, Paris 7, France.